Thank you all, Madam Speaker, Madam Vice President. No president has ever said those words from this podium. No president has ever said those words, and it's about time.
President Joe Biden last night making his first address to a joint session of Congress to mark his first 100 days in office. Biden began by acknowledging the two women sitting behind him, Vice President Kamala Harris and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, also two women from California. It's the first time in American history both positions have been held by women. We're going to look now at how Harris has spent her first 100 days in office. Most publicly, she's been using her voice as a woman of color and former California Attorney General to connect with the Black community after the Derek Chauvin trial, and to speak out against xenophobia after the spa shooting in Atlanta. She has a bigger portfolio, and that resides on earning the trust of President Biden. Here to talk about all this is Christopher Catalogo. He's White House correspondent for Politico. Hi.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. What is in her portfolio? It even expanded last night, it appeared, during Biden's speech. What is she now responsible for?
So the announcement last night in particular was about rural broadband and overseeing the administration's effort to bring broadband to all different parts of the country. It's one that that she's talked passionately about having come from California and knowing the tech sector there. The most high profile role that she has so far is looking at the root causes with the Northern Triangle countries of migration to the U.S. and to the border. And that is something that has been controversial, given that it's opened her up to attacks from Republicans who see her as the sort of border czar, even though that's not the role itself. And it's landed her in meetings with officials from that area. Those have kind of added to the meetings that she's already done with foreign leaders from across the world. And so that's another piece of it, is sort of boning up on national security and diplomacy. And some of these things have been something of a crash course for her. You know, she was elected to the Senate in 2016 from California, obviously ran for president, an endeavor that took a couple years for her to do. And now as Joe Biden's vice president, those were some areas, the immigration portfolio, or at least the root causes, the diplomacy. She's, of course, the 51st vote in the U.S. Senate. So she maintains her ties there. Some of those were things that Joe Biden had been tasked to do by Barack Obama. And so he sees those as important things that he wants his vice president to work on.
This particular assignment that you mentioned about rooting out the root causes of migration and meeting with officials in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, that seems like it could be a thankless job, one setting her up for at least not an unqualified success, as it's been a thorny issue through many administrations. And many administrations have not solved the immigration problem, the immigration crisis. And so how does she view that assignment? Is that something that she is eagerly taking on, or something that she's taking on with a bit of doubt as to why she was handed it in the first place?
Well, we kind of started the segment talking about one of the primary goals she's had going into this was to really earn Joe Biden's trust, and not just Joe Biden, but the trust of his top advisors, people who have been with him for decades, and want to know that first and foremost, her objective is advancing their collective agenda. And I think when you're offered something, whether it's politically expedient or not, this was something Joe Biden wanted her to do, and by accepting it, you're moving forward in earning that trust. You know, it's vice presidents have to take up some thorny issues. It can certainly have some thankless elements to it. The power of that job is essentially derived from how much trust and authority the president gives you. And there is not a lot of constitutional power there. And so I think she understands that. Joe Biden understands that. And so whether it's politically expedient in the short term or not. She saw it as something that she had to do. And I think the goal of it, obviously, we saw in the Trump administration, a lot of the aid to those countries, a lot of the pacts that Joe Biden had helped write under Obama with some of those countries for aid, ending, looking to root out some of the corruption there in government and society, are things that take a while. And there's been sort of a restart post-Trump. The Trump administration clearly didn't believe that sending aid to those countries was part of its overall immigration outlook. And so there's going to be a restart. This is going to take time. I think part of it is just her, how well she does in setting that narrative, setting public expectations on immigration. But certainly when we see these surges of folks coming over the border, you know, it will be something that people point to her on.
Yeah. And you do allude to a certain tension in her position. As you say, she needs to earn the trust of Joe Biden to make sure that she is actually influential and has actual real power and is not just window dressing. But at the same time, she can't, you know, she's also got to look to her political future. She's a young woman, and Biden may be a one-term president. So how does she strike that balance between not looking overly ambitious and yet keeping an eye on her own political future?
It's a very, very difficult tightrope, and it's made more difficult by the fact that we really don't know whether Joe Biden is going to run for re-election. And I only say that because of his age. And so, you know, she could be looking at a very short, you know, 2-year horizon if he doesn't run in 2024 to really get things up and moving for herself politically. Or she could be looking at something more like 6 or 7 years, in which case it doesn't really need to be an immediate concern for her. And so that's kind of the first question that we can't answer. The other is that there are just things you do as a politician to keep yourself sort of ready and available. We know that there are donors all across the country who like to hear from elected officials who consider themselves very important. And so there are just behind the scenes, I guess you would call it political maintenance that she needs to do that are less about entertaining the idea publicly and more about whether she is able to keep that up. And I think she's also a bit hamstrung in that sense. We know Mike Pence, for as potentially insecure as you might have seen Donald Trump as a politician, he allowed Mike Pence to maintain a political committee that he raised money in and sort of dished out to other candidates. Kamala Harris does not have that kind of committee for herself. Under Joe Biden. Kamala Harris is raising money like Joe Biden is for the Democratic Party and for the 2022 midterm elections. So we'll see how much of that maintenance she does. Publicly, there is not a lot of leeway for her to act, you know, act in her own way politically.
Right. And it has only been 100 days. So it is early days. Christopher Catalago, White House correspondent for Politico. Thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thank you.
Well, as we just talked about, Vice President Harris is overseeing the situation at the U.S. border. The administration came in with a promise to undo the harsh immigration policies of the Trump era, but it is still using one of the most controversial of those policies, Title 42, put in place around the start of the pandemic. And it closed the border to all non-essential travel and authorized the expulsion of asylum seekers without due process. That's left migrants and their families vulnerable to kidnapping and extortion by criminal gangs just on the other side of the border. LA Times immigration and security reporter Molly O'Toole joins us now to talk about it. Welcome back to Press Play, Molly.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you spoke to one immigration lawyer who described this policy as, quote, a gold rush for human smugglers. What does that mean?
What it means is this is sort of this policy is a sort of payday for these criminal organizations that have operated for a long time on the U.S. On the Mexico side of the U.S.-Mexico border, particularly in northern Mexico. we tend to think of the cartels, the drug cartels that really do control all the major routes through Mexico and control the border itself and essentially decide who gets to cross. But we're talking about sort of freelancers, smaller organizations that essentially have to pay the cartels, but they operate and make their money off of exploiting vulnerable migrants. So the way that this policy works, Title 42, which was put into place in March of 2020, but Biden has kept, all migrants are expelled very quickly. That's the goal in order to, quote unquote, limit potential COVID exposure. So they're if they're Central American or Mexican, they are expelled to Mexico. They sometimes are expelled hundreds of miles away from where they crossed with no one to receive them. Oftentimes, Border Patrol agents don't tell them where they're going or what's happening. Sometimes these expulsions are happening on an average of 90 minutes, and they're expelled as opposed to remain in Mexico, for example, the other program that Trump started, they're expelled without a court date or a record of an asylum claim. So you're taking already vulnerable people, putting them in a very vulnerable situation in some of the most dangerous cities in the world that are controlled by these criminal organizations who make their money off of kidnapping migrants and then extorting their U.S. family members.
And so basically it happens almost as soon as they are sent back across the border. The kidnappers are just waiting for them, and they're mainly women and children?
Exactly. So primarily right now, so the Biden administration did make a decision in February. Now, it was a decision that was prompted in part by adverse court rulings against their ability to use Title 42, in addition to a new Mexican law where that says that the Mexican government can't detain children, whether unaccompanied or with their parents, in immigration detention. Those two things combined, the Biden administration said that they aren't going to use Title 42 anymore against unaccompanied minors. But they are still using Title 42 against kids, so long as they're with their parents. So there are a significant number of families, 17,000 just in March alone, that have been expelled in this way. So very quickly, especially if they're Central American families, because they're sent almost directly back to Mexico, in an average of 90 minutes, like we said, they just do a kind of cursory, Border Patrol agents do a cursory health check. They don't allow them to claim asylum in almost all circumstances, and take down their biometric information, and then they just send them right back.
Isn't that illegal, though, not to let them claim asylum?
So that's a great question. Three federal judges have suggested that Title 42 is illegal for that exact reason, but essentially we haven't gotten a ruling on the merits as of yet. The Trump administration's argument was that Title 42, which is what this policy has become known by, but it refers to an obscure 1944 public health statute that has never been used in this way before. And the Trump administration's argument, which was pretty controversial in the legal world, was that this obscure statute from 1944 that's never been used in this way before overrides every single other U.S. law, including due process, including the Immigration and Nationality Act, which establishes a migrant's right to claim asylum. That was their argument. And then essentially when the Biden administration came in, despite being very critical of Title 42 and other policies such as Remain in Mexico, which was the very first time that asylum seekers and non-Mexicans were ever forced back to Mexico by the United States. Despite being very critical of those policies, they quietly kept Title 42 and in many ways have embraced it to try and keep numbers down at the border.
They know what's happening. They know that there's all this kidnapping. And how many people have been kidnapped in the last, I don't know, since Joe Biden has been president?
So there are advocacy groups and legal groups that have documented at least 500 cases that they know of, but it is very difficult to know how many people have been kidnapped and how many families are being extorted, because the FBI will tell you, or Homeland Security investigations, which also is part of the Department of Homeland Security, works on these cases, will tell you they're severely underreported. There's a lot of fear about reporting, not just from the kidnappers, but from corrupt Mexican officials. There's essentially impunity for these crimes in Mexico, and often they're not investigated in the United States. So it's difficult for us to know, but from what research indicates, at least 500 cases just since January alone that have been documented. We spoke to, three Central American mothers who were kidnapped almost immediately after being removed from the United States with their children, despite asking for asylum. So it is common. It is well known. I mean, the U.S. State Department advises U.S. citizens not to travel to these parts of the border because of the risk of kidnapping. So it is well known. But essentially, at this point, they're accepting it as a cost of keeping numbers down at the border.
Right. I think you say that the State Department likens these places right across the Texas border to Iraq and Syria in terms of how dangerous they are. As you say, Kamala Harris was vocal about this and said it violated U.S. and international law. What is she and the administration now saying about that, if anything?
As far as I know, Vice President Kamala Harris has not been asked directly about this policy. They have been very clear in giving her this sort of portfolio of dealing with the root causes of migration, that doesn't deal with the border. It's very hard to separate those two things, but that's what they're trying to do. But the Biden administration was asked about Title 42, President Biden was asked about Title 42 in his first press conference. He said that more families should be going back, that they should all be going back to Mexico, and that they would send more back if they could, but that they can't at the moment, and they're negotiating with the Mexican government because the Mexican government won't take back everyone, particularly families with young children, particularly in Tamaulipas, that area that you referred to that the State Department says is as dangerous as Iraq, Syria, Yemen. So the administration has said that this remains necessary because of public health, at the same time as they've acknowledged that they are keeping it in place.
That's Molly O'Toole, immigration and security reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, why are wealthy Californians buying up rental property in Milwaukee, Wisconsin? That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Milwaukee, Wisconsin, nestled along the shore of Lake Michigan, home to Miller Beer and Harley-Davidson motorcycles. To be honest, it's not a city we think about here in Southern California often, unless maybe you're a commercial landlord. 6,000 rental properties in Milwaukee are now owned by out-of-state speculators. That has quadrupled in the past 20 years. Many of those companies are actually located right here in California. They buy up homes for cheap and then rent them out to sometimes vulnerable tenants. Carrie Spivak joins me now. He's an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's been taking a look at this. Welcome to the program, Carrie.
Oh, my pleasure to be there.
Well, why Milwaukee? What is the attraction? And it's not just for out-of-state landlords here in California, but for landlords in other places in the country too, and even out of the country. Why?
The key word is cheap. The property here is cheap, especially compared to Southern California, but compared to many other markets as well, Chicago, Minneapolis, what have you, in the Midwest. The average assessed value of the properties owned by the nine largest out-of-state landlords here is in the low 60s. So the low 60s isn't going to buy you much in LA, but it can buy you a couple of a duplex here.
Well, it might buy you a fancy car what it would do.
That's right.
So low 60s, you can buy a house. And so they're not buying just one house. They're buying a bunch of houses, right? A single company?
Oh, that's true. In fact, back in, I think it was about 2016 or so, two guys who had worked in the Silicon Valley in California, that's when they first entered the business of single family rentals. And they purchased, I believe it was 50 some properties in 2017 for $4.5 million. And they've developed that now into a company that's in about more than a dozen states and owns more than 4,000 properties. And they hope to own $2.5 billion with a B dollars worth of rental properties within the next couple of years.
And these two guys, they met at Harvard and named their company after their Harvard rowing team?
Yeah, that's correct. They have two companies. One is HVL-97-MKE and a couple other things. And the HVL has to do with the Harvard row, I think it's lightweight rowing team. And their other company is SFR, Single Family Rental. I talked briefly to Jonathan Kibera, who's was with Google. He would not return future calls, but he did say that they were basically entrepreneurs, not real estate guys, and they saw an opportunity and they took them, as they say.
And if they're not real estate guys, they're not landlords, and yet they own all this property, how are they taking care of these properties? And how are all of these out-of-state landlords in general taking care of these properties?
Depends on the company. SFR3 does not have a ton of building code violations like some of the others. They are aggressive at evictions. The citywide average eviction rate in Milwaukee for landlords is 8.6 per 100 units per year. SFR3 is about 39.2. And building code violations, they're not bad, but there's a couple of companies here that are out-of-state companies that have more than or have had more than 700 violations in their properties. We've talked to some of the tenants. They talk about having rodents there, not being able to get anything fixed, so on and so forth. Now, we have some local landlords who are pretty bad too, but at least with a local landlord, the tenants say they got somebody to talk to or yell at. With an out-of-stater, they'll probably not even know the name of the person who owns their property.
Yeah. So what is the process? Like, they'll come in, buy up these properties, and then, as you say, they've got a higher eviction rate. When they're trying to evict a tenant, do they then try to do that so that they can jack up the rent?
What it is if you're behind on the rent, they'll give you, in Wisconsin state law, you get a 5-day notice, and then eventually they will file the eviction. They may or may not jack up the rent for the next guy. You know, part of this is myth, but part of it is true. If you have a local landlord, you have a better chance of saying, look, I'm a little bit behind on the rent because I had this bill, or, you know, a child is sick or what have you. Can you cut me some slack? You have a fighting chance. On an out-of-state landlord, you have much less of a chance, especially if it's an absentee landlord with thousands of properties.
What kind of profits are these companies making? They must see this as a good investment or they wouldn't be doing it.
Oh, yeah, they do good. There is one company that's in Southern California, in Torrance, California, High Grove, and they have said that the properties in Milwaukee, they have about 130, provides, this is their words, quote, provides tremendous cash flow of 12 to 18% returns annually. And they also say that each property generates gross annualized return rate of just over 20%, and in some cases over 30%. That's pretty good money.
That is it. And that's just from rents?
But yeah, that's the only income you're going to get that I could think of from a property. Rent, I guess fines if you're late on the rent, that type of thing, but generally rent. And it depends a lot too on how much money they put into the property. Highgrove has said that they generally can purchase and rehab a property in Milwaukee for 35 grand. That's not a ton of money. The properties that I've seen look decent. The president and owner of the company said words the effect of, we give our renters a Chevrolet, not a Cadillac.
You wrote that the single family rental industry didn't exist 10 years ago, but is just poised to really take off. Why?
Well, it started... After the recession, you had a lot of properties became available at very cheap prices. So they were able to scoop them up, and there's always been landlords, obviously, but created into this industry and taken advantage of everything that volume gives you, every advantage it gives you to increase your profits. And it took off there. It didn't really come to Milwaukee in the Midwest until probably starting around 15 or 16. You have out in the West Coast, a company, Invitation Homes, that owns 80,000 properties. In Milwaukee, the largest company that we found was Vinebrook Homes. They're based in Dayton, Ohio, and they have approximately 14,000 properties that they're renting out. And I mentioned SFR3, the Harvard guys, like I said, they have about 4,000 properties in a dozen or so states.
And they hope to increase that, as you say.
Yeah, to $2.5 billion, yeah.
Wow.
Which is not a bad increase.
Not a bad increase. Carrie Spivak from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Coming up, how stand-up comedy evolved from its origins in minstrel shows.
As each new generation takes the field, a new way of doing comedy is introduced that's sort of acceptable to the crowds at that time.
The history of stand-up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, before the pandemic hit, there was a stand-up comedy boom underway. Dave Chappelle did a 16-night residency at Radio City Music Hall. Kevin Hart sold out a football stadium in Philly that seats more than 67,000 people. Netflix was putting out a new stand-up comedy special, it seemed, every week. HBO, Showtime, Comedy Central, Amazon, Hulu, all on the stand-up special train, too. Even the 80s-style two-drink minimum comedy clubs were thriving in many cities before the pandemic shut them down. Well, whether COVID caused the comedy bust remains to be seen, but stand-up has boomed and busted before. Wayne Fetterman is a comedian who teaches stand-up performance and history at USC. In his new book, he traces the comedy booms, the busts, and the evolution of this art form since pre-vaudeville times. The book is called The History of Stand-Up, from Mark Twain to Dave Chappelle, and Wayne Fetterman joins me now. Welcome to Press Play.
Did you write that? Did somebody write that for you? Because that was really impressive.
I did not
write
that. Thank
okay.
you. I have a writer's room, like many comedians do.
Oh, man. That is something. I actually, in the book, The History of Stand-Up, I know it sounds like I'm pushing the book. I'm not. We can talk about
you
anything.
Are pushing the book.
But, yeah, the writer's room started during radio in the 1930s.
Well, we're going to get to that.
Okay. Sorry to jump.
That's okay. All in due time. Let's begin at the beginning and talk about a man named Artemus Ward. Fantastic name. And why is he the beginning of your story? What did he do to establish stand-up comedy?
Well, he created something. Artemus Ward is a pen name. Artemus Ward's real name, believe it or not, is Charles Brown, Charlie Brown.
Oh.
And he was a newspaper dude in Cleveland at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And he would write these funny letters that with misspelled words and sign them Artemus Ward, this character he created. And this created a sensation. It was reprinted in newspapers all across the country, and he became famous. So that's incredible right there. Then he takes it to another level because part of his job is covering the local entertainment scene in Cleveland. And who strolls into town? A traveling minstrel show. And in the minstrel show, one of the interlocutor, who is like the MC, starts doing jokes out of one of his Artemus Ward columns. And it's getting laughs. He's like, what the heck? I didn't realize that my printed word could be repurposed for stage. So he creates this show called Stories About the Baby. And he gets on stage. And people already knew him, Artemus Ward, the famous writer guy. And he does an hour, 20 minutes, just standing on stage all by himself. And he doesn't ever talk about stories about the baby. Everything is a misdirect. He's like going to get to it, but first he has to get to this, which reminds him of this, which reminds him of this. And people go berserk. They love it. And so he becomes like this traveling stand-up comedian in the late 1861, 1860, as the Civil War is starting. It's like, and he's traveling the country as Artemus Ward, making like the equivalent of like over $30,000 a night today, because he
wow.
is
so he is
selling
the Dave
out
Chappelle, really, of
he is,
18,
he is the,
of the 1860s.
Yeah. But what's important about him is not only that he created this and he showed how you can stand on stage by yourself and get laughs, and that's enough for being a show. It's not a variety show. There's no juggling. There's no dancing girls. It's just him. But guess who sees him? Samuel Clemens. And that inspires him to do his own way more successful, way more culturally significant comedy tours as Mark Twain.
That was very extensive and interesting.
Thank you.
Early history of stand-up comedy.
Right.
What's also really interesting in your book is the through line of race. As you say, he got his idea from a minstrel show.
Yep.
There's another character in your book named Bert Williams, and he is America's first Black superstar comedian.
No question.
Tell us about him and how he was instrumental in stand-up comedy.
Well, he's, I don't know if he's instrumental. I would say he was inspirational in stand-up comedy because he had this character called the Jonah Man, which was basically, if he didn't have bad luck, he would have no luck at all. Like if it was raining soup, he would have a fork. That was kind of thing. So sort of the loser guy cut to
Rodney. He's a schlemazel.
Yeah, cut to Rodney Dangerfield. Years later, it's the same kind of thing. Like the guy can't catch a break. So anyway, so he broke the color line for the Ziegfeld Follies, which was the biggest review of its era. You may have seen the movie Funny Girl. They talk about the Ziegfeld Follies. Fanny Bryce got her big break in a Follies show. And W.C. Fields said that he was the funniest man that he ever saw on stage and the saddest off stage, because he would like play the theater or go up, you know, hang out with Eddie Cantor, and they would have to go in the back door of the hotel because they weren't allowed in the lobby of the hotel. So it was just indignity after indignity. And yet he transcended it all by finding incredible humanity in his humor. But he was in a minstrel show. He started out a minstrel show in San Francisco. And so that's the unfortunate beginnings of stand-up comedy can be traced kind of to these minstrel shows.
Well, there's a through line through a lot of the, you know, history of comedy, right? And it goes right up to Dick Gregory and Richard Pryor and Dave Chappelle.
Yeah, so, well, it's, yeah, up till really 1961, it was very much a separate but equal situation. There was a few super talented guys. Bert Williams was the most, but even Moms Mabley was basically siloed in Chitlin Circuit. But then in 1961, the door sort of opened up and African Americans could perform on stages and in the Catskill Mountains or in Vegas.
Well, let's go back to vaudeville for just a second and talk about one of the most famous comedians in American history who began in vaudeville and then transitioned to radio and then, of course, to screen. And that is Bob Hope. This is a week after the 1948 presidential election when Harry Truman, who was the incumbent, famously upset the New York governor by the name of Thomas Dewey, who had been expected to win. Remember all those newspaper headlines? And here's Bob Hope.
And last Tuesday night, Drew Pearson said over the radio, "I predict Dewey will be elected by 10:30. At 11 o'clock, he said, "I predict Dewey." At 12, he said, "I predict." The next morning, he said,
Okay, well, we talked about the writer's room. Bob Hope was the first guy, right, to have a writer's room because he had so much work to do on the radio.
Well, he's not the first person to have a writer's room, but he did spend a lot of his budget, more than maybe any other radio comedian, on writers, and made that part of his persona, that he had this group of guys that would send him these gags. I would guess most jokes you ever heard from Bob Hope were written by incredible Yankee level comedy writers.
So radio is where a lot of comedy flourished. But then, of course, TV comes along and snatches all that away. The Ed Sullivan Show, can you talk a little bit about that? Because he was an unlikely host who had a show for decades.
Yeah, from 1948 till 1971. But he was this very wooden, non-telegenic guy who put on a variety show in the earliest days of network television, which is the late 40s. And it's the show isn't even called the Ed Sullivan Show because they want to fire this guy right away, the sponsor, and get somebody who can actually present on television. But the show slowly becomes a hit and he becomes ingrained, and they change the name from Toast of the Town to the Ed Sullivan Show. But what's important in the history of stand-up is that he would present stand-up comedians on almost every show, unless it was like a theme show, like a Broadway theme show. So it was the first kind of like real destination booking for stand-up comedians mm-hmm. before Carson, before Netflix, before HBO, that you got to go on the Ed Sullivan Show and do your stand-up comedy.
And the bookers from his show would go trolling these Greenwich Village clubs to find the young talent, right?
That's right, later on.
A lot of the big names were discovered.
Yes. Well, it's interesting because the Sullivan era, it covers a number of different eras of television. It starts out in the nightclub era. After vaudeville, nightclubs became the number one spot for comedians to perform in. And then there was something called presentation houses, which were these big 6,000 seat theaters that would show a movie and then have a little variety show. But then the Greenwich Village scene, where Joan Rivers and Woody and Carlin and Pryor all were starting out. And yes, Sullivan would get all of those guys on the show.
Wow.
So it's just a fascinating kind of history lesson of, as each new generation takes the field, a new way of doing comedy is introduced that's sort of acceptable to the crowds at that time.
Well, one of the guys who did that was a man named Robert Klein.
Yes.
Let's hear a little bit of his early work.
When you try to start your car on a cold winter morning, the car seems to talk to you in a kind of poem of twisted, frozen steel. You know, put the key in the ignition, you go, please don't try to start me.
So how is his style groundbreaking, and how did he influence later comedians?
So he's kind of the first of the comedy club comedians, the sort of breakthrough. And he has this, it's not shticky, like just straight up observation, right? That's something, we all recognize this. We've all started a car. Whereas opposed to that Bob Hope joke was straight up political, old school Will Rogers. I'm going to make a joke about a current event. So in a way, Klein's is part of this wave of what's called observational comedy. He didn't start it, but he certainly popularized it, really inspired a whole host of comedians. Jerry Seinfeld, Paul Reiser, Larry Miller, Jon Stewart all point to him as like, oh, I can do comedy like this. It's like very much part of my life, as opposed to I'm a comedian in a suit and I'm doing jokes about mother-in-laws or something like that. So he's hugely influential for that whole first generation of comedy club comics.
Another hugely influential comic is Richard Pryor. And so he releases this live in concert performance. And here he is.
White people, this is the fun part for me when the white people come back after intermission and find out niggas and stole their seats.
Sitting here, dear, weren't we? I believe we were sitting here, weren't we?
Yes, we were sitting right there.
Well, you ain't sitting here now, mother.
So you say that film is an achievement that stands above all others. And I mean, this was the 70s. This was an incredible decade for comedy. But how did Richard Pryor and that performance change the comedy landscape?
One, it was the first time there was a full-length motion picture where you went inside a movie theater and watched someone do an hour and 20 minutes, whatever that is, of straight stand-up. There was a critic from the Village Voice who said it was one of the most thrilling moments of his life watching movies, was watching this one guy on stage. So now stand-up is elevated to a level that it never had been. Even with Bob Hope and all of those guys that went before them, no one had ever seen anything quite like this. And it's still staggering to watch today.
Okay, so let's fast forward to the present. And where are we now with comedy? I know we took a big 1 year pause, but where are we? Where are we now with it?
Well, before the coronavirus hit, we were in what was, a lot of people were calling the second stand-up comedy boom, which was the first one was in the 80s with the clubs and Evening at the Improv and all of that stuff. But then the internet sort of fueled this new wave of comedians that could connect with their fans in a very direct way. And also the streaming service Netflix and podcasting, obviously, Twitter, Instagram. You know, we're in this weird world where for a year, comedians found different ways to perform that wasn't directly on stage, which has sort of been the main point of stand-up since Artemus Ward, that you had to perform on stage and get the reaction of the crowd. And that's no longer the case always.
Wayne Fetterman, his new book is called The History of Stand-Up from Mark Twain to Dave Chappelle. Wayne, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Rotten Tomatoes drama with the movie Paddington 2 getting a better rating than Citizen Kane. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The 1941 film Citizen Kane has long been considered the best movie ever made. And for years, its score on Rotten Tomatoes reflected that. It sat atop the leaderboards as the site's highest reviewed piece of cinema. That is, until this week, when an archival review panning the film was added to the website, effectively killing Kane's perfect rating and bringing another film to the top.
Paddington!
Paddington?
Paddington.
Paddington! Sorry.
That's right. Paddington, based on the children's books about an adorable bear living in London who wears a blue raincoat and a red bucket hat. It was actually Paddington 2 that ascended to a perfect 100. Citizen Kane is now 99. Rosebud? More like Rose Bear. Tim Gerson is senior U.S. critic for Screen International and the author of the new book, This Is How You Make a Movie. He joined us for our Friday film review segment back in 2018 when Paddington 2 first opened in theaters. And he joins me now. Hi.
Hi there, Madeline.
Well, before we get into the whys of this dethroning, I want to play a clip from your review. Here it is.
I think it's pretty darn fun. I thought the first one from a couple years ago was very fun. I mean, both of these movies are super British and super cheeky, but it's really charming. It's really funny. And especially like the jokes in it. The first half an hour, 45 minutes, they're like these like throwaway gags that end up being important later in the movie.
Okay, Tim, you are a Paddington 2 super fan? Are you surprised it's now a number, perfect 100 on the tomato meter?
It's funny because there are actually several films on Rotten Tomatoes that are at 100%. It's just that Citizen Kane now isn't. What's really interesting about this story is that the Rotten Tomatoes has been doing this archival project where they go back and find older reviews for older movies that were never part of their website review system, and they've been adding them to these older movies. And so somebody over there found this kind of negative to mixed review that was in the Chicago Tribune back in 1941 when Citizen Kane came out, and added it. And then people started to like discover, wait, why isn't Citizen Kane at 100% anymore? And there's actually several movies on the Rotten Tomatoes site that are at 100%, like 12 Angry Men is at 100%. The original Terminator is at 100%. But when the first articles that was written about this came out, the writer just sort of arbitrarily mentioned, well, Paddington 2 is at 100%, so therefore it's greater than Citizen Kane. And so because of that, all of these other websites picked up that news and reported it as Paddington 2 is now the greatest movie ever made, when it's just one of many on the Rotten Tomatoes site that's at 100%.
But still, for it to be in the same ballpark as The Maltese Falcon, Singing in the Rain, Citizen Kane. I mean, really?
Yeah. I mean, what's really interesting about Rotten Tomatoes, I think just in general, is that because their tomato meter, as they call it, is based on whether a reviewer gives a movie a fresh rating or a rotten rating. It's kind of like the thumbs up, thumbs down that Siskel and Ebert used to do on their show back in the day. And so if you simply like a movie and you think it's good, it will get a fresh. So the fact that Paddington 2 is at 100% fresh, there are a lot of people who really love that movie. Don't get me wrong, but it's more kind of funny that this story sort of took off and people were like offended, like, how dare Citizen Kane not be the greatest movie, and how dare it be this movie about an animated bear who's British. And, you know, there's an idea, I think, sometimes that we as a film culture sometimes get a little too concerned about certain movies being in the canon and always being sort of treated as the greatest movies ever made. And because of that, sometimes movies that are dismissed as being only kids' movies or only comedies aren't taken as seriously. So that juxtaposition between Citizen Kane and Paddington 2 this week was really sort of telling in terms of how people responded.
Yeah. Well, let's just look at Citizen Kane for a moment. And do you think, you just wrote a book about movies. I mean, you're an expert, if anyone's an expert. Do you think it's the greatest movie of all time? It certainly is discussed as such.
It's a really, really amazing, wonderful film. I don't think it's the greatest film of all time. If I was going to make a pick, I would pick 2001, A Space Odyssey. But when you're talking about Citizen Kane, it's in the pantheon. It's one of the movies that needs to be discussed in terms of the history of cinema. Anybody who is starting out as a young person wanting to know, like, what are the movies I should be watching? Citizen Kane is definitely one of them. Whether or not it's the greatest of all time, it's sort of like saying, is Sgt. Pepper the greatest album of all time? It's like, well, it's in that discussion. Maybe it's not the greatest, but, you know, it's definitely something that people should see. It's a movie that people should remember.
And why? If you haven't seen Citizen Kane, why is it so great?
I think it's partly because so many techniques that we now take completely for granted in movies were really developed by Orson Welles, who wrote or co-wrote and directed that movie. He either developed those or kind of came up with them. The idea of, you know, deep focus photography, this idea that you could see everything on screen from the front of the frame to the back of the frame, just the complexity of the storytelling. There have been complex movies before that. Orson Welles' background was in theater and in radio, and he was very inventive in both of those mediums. And he took that same kind of approach to movies. This was his first film, and it really felt like he was trying to reinvent everything in the movie medium. And the movie medium was only like, you know, 20, 30 years old by that point.
And he was only 25.
Yeah, he was very incredible. You know, you can watch that movie, and I've seen it so many times over the years. That movie feels like a movie made by a young person. And I mean that in the best possible way. It's so full of enthusiasm and ambition and excitement. You feel a 20-something filmmaker going, I can't believe I get to do this. Another thing I think that makes the movie always so resonant is it's such an American story. It's the story of this guy, Charles Foster Kane, who comes from nothing but gets a lot of money and becomes very ambitious and wants to become eventually president of the United States, and how his ambitions ultimately prove to be his downfall. It's such an American story. That's such a resonant, like, idea that we have in this country about people who rise and then fall. And that's another reason why I think people, you know, keep watching and keep returning to that movie.
So when are we going to see the fall of Paddington?
Well, I have to tell you, it's you can sense that somebody out there is scrounging across the internet trying to find like a negative or mixed review of Paddington 2 so they can bring it down. I'm sure at some point somebody will find a review. But put it this way, if you're at 100% Rotten Tomatoes or you're at 99% like Citizen Kane is, congratulations, you've made a pretty well-liked movie by critics, and people will probably want to check that movie out. I think Paddington 2 should probably watch behind his back, because there may be someone trying to like take it down now. But Paddington's gone through enough already, Madeline. I feel like he shouldn't have to suffer anymore.
Tim Grierson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International and author of the new book, This Is How You Make a Movie. Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for us today on Press Play. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.